What's the best way to treat lazy eye in kids?
Modifying the immune system to treat lung cancer.
Are high-dose statins really helpful?
And a tool to assess reducing your cardiovascular risk.
That's what we're talking about this week on PodMed, the weekly look at the medical headlines from Johns Hopkins, posted on November 11th, 2016. I'm Elizabeth Tracy.
And I'm Rick Lang, professor of medicine at Johns Hopkins, president of Texas Tech University Health Sciences Center El Paso, and dean of the Paul L. Foster School of Medicine.
Welcome back to the country, Rick. You had a wonderful time cycling.
It was a great time in France cycling and enjoying the weather, the food, and the wine.
And here you are. Before we get started, I want to call out to Mark Benner, a physician who wrote to us a couple weeks ago relative to a study we covered that was in the New England Journal of Medicine looking at screening children for familial hypercholesterolemia as a way to getting to their parents, actually, and managing that. We want to give Mark kudos for such a thoughtful and discerning reply. He actually brought to our awareness, or mine anyway, that if women were going to attempt to be pregnant and they were the ones with the hypercholesterolemia, they really shouldn't be on statins.
And as you mentioned, we enjoy hearing from our listeners and we appreciate the thoughtful reply. So Mark, thanks so much for writing us and thanks for being a faithful listener.
And we hope to hear from you again. Please keep on doing that kind of stuff. Let's turn now to the studies I served up. Hey, what's the best way to treat lazy eye in children? That's in JAMA Ophthalmology.
So Elizabeth, as far as I know, over the 11 plus years we've been recording, this is the first time we've talked about what is known as lazy eye or amblyopia. Many listeners may not be aware that it's the leading cause of having visual impairment due to a single eye problem, that is monocular visual impairment in children in the United States. It affects approximately 3% of children. Currently, the treatment for that is to patch the fellow eye to force the child to use the lazy eye, the amblyopia eye. Even with that therapy, somewhere between 15 to as many as 50% of kids may never achieve normal visual acuity even after a lengthy course of treatment. When it is successful, somewhere between a fourth and a half of children, it may actually recur. So this was an interesting study. It tested the eye patch versus treatment with binocular iPad games. That is, using Apple games that require both eyes to focus on the game so that it reduces the fellow eye contrast in an effort to kind of rebalance between the two eyes for an hour a day. What the investigators did was they took 28 kids, average age about 6.5 years, who had amblyopia, randomized them to the patch or to playing binocular games, and then reassessed their vision at 2 weeks and at 4 weeks. Those that received the patch had some improvement, but those that had the binocular game therapy actually had greater improvement. And at 2 weeks, those that had patch crossed over to the game, and they also had additional improvement. So at the end of 4 weeks, all kids that used the binocular game had a marked improvement compared to the patch.
And I think this is really such very great news because as a parent myself, I can recall trying to institute things that were tedious for my kids or unacceptable for my kids. And certainly a game is something that most of them really enjoy. And it's something that can be done in a multitude of locations.
Absolutely. So, I mean, I think this is a terrific study. It's only effective if the child uses it, and it has to be a game they're interested in playing. And so they had modified the game so they were of interest to this age children, and the compliance was very good.
And gosh, we could even slide in some educational content in there at some point. Maybe I shouldn't have said that. From here, why don't we move to JAMA? A look at people who are at high cardiovascular risk. Do high-dose statins help those folks?
Elizabeth, it's clear that in high-risk individuals, those that have a number of risk factors or have known cardiovascular disease, use of statins decreases either initial cardiac events or subsequent cardiac events significantly. And the higher your risk, the more effective they are at lowering your risk of having subsequent heart disease or stroke. Now, before we used to treat to a specific cholesterol level. We gauge your therapy, either calling it low, moderate, or high-intensity therapy based upon what your risk is. And we don't really worry about what the actual cholesterol numbers are. But there's been a lot of controversy about that. And there's also been concern that in the elderly individuals, those over the age of 75, that the use of high-dose statins, there isn't quite as much data. And so in those individuals, it's recommended they receive moderate therapy. So what these authors did was they performed an observational study of veterans in the United States, over 500,000. And they looked at the use of statins to first establish, is there really an association between the intensity of statin therapy and the reduction in mortality? And then furthermore, in individuals over the age of 75, does high-dose statin therapy do better than medium? And here's what they discovered. There is certainly a definite grade between the intensity of statin therapy and the reduction in mortality. The higher the dose, the better the outcome. And this is true even in individuals over the age of 75.
I guess I would also suggest that, gosh, we're seeing a ton of agents with the idea of lowering cholesterol that are either coming on the market or in late-stage clinical trials. I'm wondering if at some point there's going to be a different strategy, maybe employing more than one agent to bring it down rather than titrating the dose higher.
Well, statins have multiple effects, only one of which is to lower cholesterol. As we have also talked before, they also decrease the inflammatory state, which is incredibly important as well. So the total story probably isn't the cholesterol story. It's the combination of multiple effects. And so any drugs we have in the future are going to have to be shown not only to reduce cholesterol, but also to reduce the important secondary endpoints, death, stroke, and to be as effective as statins if they're going to replace them.
A worthy objective. Let's move from here to a study that there's at least one home team author on it. That's Julie Bramer. It's in the New England Journal of Medicine, the use of an antibody for non-small cell lung cancer.
Elizabeth, I picked this particular study to highlight a couple points. One is that we talk about personalized medicine, being able to use biomarkers or look at specific pathways in cancer cells, and now we have specific drugs that interfere with specific pathways. Unfortunately, in many cancers, a very small percentage of individuals have those pathways. We have some biomarkers in cancer that look at particular pathways, but 5 or 10% of individuals may have that particular pathway in their cancer. The immune system is important because many cancers have abnormalities in their interaction with the immune system. They're able to evade the immune system from attacking the cancer cells. Well, we have now specific what are called checkpoint inhibitors that prevent the cancers from evading that. One of these is called PD-L1 or programmed death ligand 1. And in small cell lung cancers, about a third of individuals have this particular abnormality, not only in some of the cells, but in more than 50% of the cells. So what the investigators did was they identified individuals that had this particular abnormality, and they randomized them to an inhibitor of this or to standard chemotherapy. And what they discovered was that by modifying the immune system, they were able to improve survival, and they improved duration of response to chemotherapy, and they did that with lower side effects as well.
How early in the course of the disease was this agent employed?
Well, this was used as the primary therapy. And the other thing I would say is that although we've identified these pathways, over the course of therapy, oftentimes there are ways that the cancer get around these pathways. So these things have not been curative yet, so it's unlikely to be a single agent, but a multiplicity of agents. This may be an important one.
And certainly we're going to be seeing a whole lot more of this targeted therapy in all kinds of cancers, not just non-small cell lung cancer. Finally, let's turn to another one you picked. That was in the journal Circulation, a cardiovascular risk reduction tool. I yawned when you told me that you wanted that, but this one actually has some new spins to it.
So the goal for the American Heart Association is basically to save 1 million lives over the next decade. To do that, we have to identify which patients are at risk of cardiovascular disease, let them know what that risk is, and then let them know whether there are effective ways at reducing that risk. So what the American Heart Association and American College of Cardiology have done is, based upon a number of trials that have looked at risk factors, identified the major risk factors: gender, your age, your race, your total cholesterol, your LDL and HDL cholesterols, whether you're on a statin, what your blood pressure is, are you being treated for hypertension, whether you have diabetes and smoke and/or take aspirin. If you plug in that data, this risk tool tells you what your 10-year risk is. It tells you what your expected risk would be if you change any of these things. It says, if you started on a statin, what would it lower it to? Or if you're a cigarette smoker, what would it lower if you stopped cigarette smoking? Also, what therapies might be beneficial, or conversely, which might be harmful. So let's say you're at low risk of having heart disease. If you go on aspirin, it increases your risk of bleeding, and perhaps you shouldn't be doing that. I think this is one of the most useful tools I've seen over the last decade.
Well, it's really great, of course, because it can be very, very persuasive, providing that information. Hey, if you quit smoking, you can reduce your risk from 30% to 19%. And then if you also start exercising every day and you lose some weight and all the rest of that stuff, I think that's really great. Aspirin therapy, since you brought that up, is useful in a number of other venues. And so we go back and forth about the utility of daily aspirin or every other day aspirin. And I think that what's important is to point out that this is a cardiovascular risk reduction tool and doesn't really apply to everything.
Right. We've talked before that aspirin lowers your risk of colorectal cancer. So in people that have a family history or have had polyps before or at high risk, then you might give them aspirin for some other reason. So you're right. This is about cardiovascular risk reduction.
Very good. I think this week on the blog, I'm going to talk about the amblyopia study. That's a look at this week's medical headlines from Johns Hopkins. I'm Elizabeth Tracy.
And while, Elizabeth, you'll highlight that on the blog, our listeners will be able to access the other studies and this risk reduction tool on the blog site as well. I'm Rick Lang. Y'all live well.